Committee on Workforce and Economic Development to order, and open an information hearing on that subjects. Our first panel this morning will be talking about innovation-based strategies in economic development, and we're going to be hearing a presentation from the Oregon Innovation Council. My understanding is that Senator Deckert may be just a few minutes late. So what I would like to do is we'll have him join the panel when he arrives. If we could, please invite Wally Van Valkenburgh as well as Senator Berger to come forward.
Representative Berger.
Excuse me, Representative Berger. It's a field promotion.
It's not a promotion.
Chuck and I called for a point of order. I witnessed the senator sitting here.
Yep. This is a promotion for
we handle field promotions readily here in this committee. So,
and we appreciate it.
Representative Berger, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Representative Vicki Berger. I represent the District 20, which is the Salem area. And Senator Deckert, Senator Morris, Representative Butler, and I were appointed as advisors to the Oregon Innovation Council effort during the interim, and we spent a lot of time on it. And this is sort of the first look at it. So it's sort of an overview, and I hate reading long testimony, but I'm going to read so that we get all of this sort of on the record for you, and hope that at the end your questions will delve further into what we're trying to do. But this is sort of the philosophical basis. The Oregon Innovation Council is an extraordinary example of how the power of collaboration between the public and private sectors can guide public policy. Dave Chin, the chair of the Oregon Inc., says, Oregon is small enough to actually get your hands around to form meaningful collaboration, but big enough to matter in the economy. In a global economy, the United States cannot compete with cheap land and labor commodities anymore. Cost-cutting with countries like India and China is a race to the bottom. Instead, Oregon can compete by adding value to existing products and services. For example, instead of selling unprocessed timber, selling plywood. Or discovering new products that allow Oregon companies to have a competitive edge. For example, discovering a new microtechnology that allows more processing space on silicon chips. Innovation provides companies with the best way to stay prosperous. Oregon's elected leaders recognize that industries face fierce competition in the flat world. In 2001, the legislature had the foresight to develop the Oregon Council on Knowledge and Economic Development, OCED. Senator Representative Lim certainly remembers this. Because the legislature realized that the global economy was fundamentally changing how states remain prosperous. OCED, which was chaired by Alan Alley, laid the foundation for the Oregon Innovation Council. It scanned the state and recognized Oregon's overlapping core competencies in the industrial and traded sectors and the university system. OCED developed the ethos that has continued with Oregon Inc. in order to maximize the state's return on investment. We must link the research and innovations at the higher ed institutions with the private industry base in Oregon. The best example of this principle is ONAMI, the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute, which was the one net new investment the legislature made during the 2003 legislature. ONAMI has leveraged millions of dollars of federal and private sector dollars within the past 4 years. In 2006 alone, the state's investment of $3.5 million leveraged over $28 million in federal dollars. In 2005, the legislature created Oregon Inc., which succeeded OCED, with the additional responsibilities of creating a statewide comprehensive innovation plan. The plan recommends where the public sector, through targeted investment, leveraging private industry and federal government, can stimulate Oregon's economy. The council is comprised of business, higher ed, and government leaders from across the state. The council's members spent over a year developing criteria, vetting proposals, and producing the innovation plan, which we present today. Fundamentally, this plan is about investing in our indigenous advantages, where Oregon already has a competitive advantage like sustainability, nanotechnology, ocean wave energy, food processing, manufacturing, etc., to enable companies to continue creating high-paid jobs in Oregon. If we want to grow, we must continue to innovate in our best advantages. I will go on and talk about the specific recommendations that are within this proposal. But let me talk a little bit about how ANAMI is put together, or how the innovation plan is put together. It represents the best in a public-private partnership. More than 40 statewide leaders from industry, higher ed, and government put over 1,000 volunteer hours over the course of a year to identify what is basically a roadmap that will maximize the return on the state's investment. These investments are designed to support the type of research and business initiatives that create family wage jobs, generate new markets for Oregon products, and maintain a skilled workforce. These investments are returned to the public in the form of increased personal and corporate revenues to the state. In addition, businesses may be encouraged to locate here because public investments support clusters, a grouping of similar businesses that share resources and expertise, further stimulating economic expansion. Examples of successful clusters in Oregon include high-tech, nursery stock, grass seed growers, clothing, footwear designers, and winemakers. The recommendation is that the innovation plan is a comprehensive package designed to build on Oregon's competitive advantage. Oops, that's the same thing. It contains both policy and funding recommendation. The funding recommendations comprise a complete portfolio balancing investments in emerging industry with those in Oregon's core established industries and investments in short-term returns with those of long-term capacity building. The policy recommendations focus on increasing the state's capacity for innovation, making it easier for innovative firms to launch anywhere in Oregon by increasing the availability of early stage capital and improving the tech transfer process. Let me go through what the portfolio is in just brief. The first is ONAMI. It includes continued investment in the state's successful first signature research center, the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute. A signature research center is a collaboration between multiple universities, research institutions, and private industry to conduct cutting-edge research in an area where Oregon has a competitive advantage. Established in 2003, ONAMI has generated an average return of 10 federal dollars for every state dollar invested in research. In 07-09, investment in ONAMI will focus on commercialization. This will be translating ONAMI research into new companies and jobs. That's the real purpose here. The other pieces of the portfolio, bioeconomy and sustainable technology signature research. The plan recommends the establishment of two new signature research centers. The first is focused on research and development in clean energy, bio-based products, and green buildings. This center will build on Oregon's existing international reputation as a leader in renewable energy, leveraging ONAMI technology platforms and bolstering Oregon's rural economy by creating new value-added products, including renewable energy sources from forest and agricultural land. Infectious disease drug discovery signature research. That's a mouthful. The plan recommends the establishment of an additional signature research center to develop and commercialize new drugs to fight infectious diseases. The institute will provide access to drug development, resources that many companies cannot afford to build themselves, including screening, preclinical models, chemical libraries, and lead optimization Don't ask me what that is. Bridging the gaps between research, and lead optimization. Bridging the gap between research, development, and commercialization in the area of infectious diseases. This next one is sort of my favorite. Ocean wave energy. The plan recommends helping Oregon build a sustainable industry on the Oregon coast during the next 20 years by harnessing powerful ocean waves to generate electricity. Oregon has been identified as the best site in the United States for this emerging energy technology, giving the state the opportunity to create a first-in-the-nation network of offshore devices feeding power to our electrical grid. The first step is a pilot project on the Oregon coast funded by the Oregon Inc. This emerging industry will create jobs for operations along the coast and provide manufacturing opportunities to build equipment. Imagine it. Manufacturing. The plan invests in the enhancement of training and R&D resources for value-added manufacturing processes to ensure Oregon has an advanced manufacturing workforce that will stay competitive in the global economy. Oregon is the most manufacturing-dependent state in the western United States, with 12.5% of all Oregon jobs in manufacturing and 211,000 individuals currently employed. This initiative will expand the Oregon Metals Initiative matching grant program and will expand capacity at Portland State University for advanced manufacturing research and development. Food processing and seafood. The plan recommends expanding vitally important food and seafood innovation centers, aiding Oregon companies to create new products, improving technology, and expanding a new market. The food industry accounts for nearly 16% of the state's unemployment and is a $20.6 billion industry for the Northwest economy. This initiative includes investment in a partnership between industry and investing an existing food innovation center to assist food processors around the state and in identifying innovative ways to expand markets. And lastly, an innovation accelerator fund. The plan recommends investment in the creation of a state innovation accelerator fund to provide ongoing funding for industry development initiatives to occur over the course of the biennium as milestones are met. This fund, developed and administered in partnership with OECD, will incent the development of new public-private sector collaborations on a regular basis, improving the quality and depth of the innovation pipeline in advance of the next biennium. That was long and complicated, so let me make just a personal aside here. We're all sort of the creature of our environment and what our experiences are, and when I walked into the 2003 session, I walked into the sixth special session, and we were talking then about jobs, jobs, and jobs. 4 years later, we're sort of sitting here giddy with this new economy, and believe me, I have not forgotten about jobs, jobs, jobs. This is exciting stuff. We're looking into the future here in trying to position ourselves so that we aren't playing defense, that we are going out and positioning Oregon in a global sense. This was a really exciting interim effort for me, and I encourage you to look and catch the sort of wave, if I can use the wave technology, of where we're going with this. Thank you, and I'll turn it over to my friend Wally here, who I didn't know before this, but we've spent a lot of time together over this effort.
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Witt, committee members. For the record, my name is Wally Van Valkenburg. I'm a lawyer with Stoll Reeves in Portland. I'm the managing partner of our Portland office. I'm also the chair of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission. Representative Berger has spoken about how the innovation plan came into being and what some of the key initiatives are. I'd like to talk for a few minutes this morning about how we think those initiatives will translate into jobs, which I think is what you're probably most interested in. I should add that as a member of the Economic Community Development Commission, I've had the privilege of serving for the past 2 years with Representative Lim, and that's been a real pleasure for me, so I'd like to just acknowledge that here this morning. I was appointed chair of the commission in September of 2003, which were the dark days. I figured we only had one way to go from there. Since the fall of 2005, I also have had the privilege of serving as an ex officio member of the Oregon Innovation Council by virtue of being chair of the Economic Development Commission. The message I'd like to give you this morning is that I believe the Innovation Plan has the potential to be one of the most significant economic development initiatives that I've seen during the 3+ years I've been on the commission. The idea behind the Innovation Plan is relatively simple. In a world where Oregonians are competing for family wage jobs, not just with California and Washington, but also with China, India, and Western Europe, we need the business leaders and the private sector to work hand in hand with the elected and other officials in the public sector to create the kind of environment where we can grow not just jobs, but high-value jobs that can't be exported. How do we do this? We do this by identifying opportunities for economic growth where Oregon already has a competitive advantage, and we propose investments to help us leverage those competitive advantages into job creation. All of the initiatives in the Innovation Plan that Representative Berger described are based on this fundamental premise. If we didn't think Oregon could do it better, we didn't recommend that it be part of the Innovation Plan. Take the Ocean Energy Wave initiative. Not only do we have a geographic advantage over other parts of the world in the development of this technology, as Representative Berger described, we also have an interdisciplinary team at Oregon State University that already is engaged in cutting-edge research and development in this area. Not only do we have electric utilities with experience in the development of renewable energy in Oregon, but we also have manufacturing companies that can produce the equipment needed to turn the waves into megawatts. We also have a well-organized consortium of companies eager to make Oregon a world leader in the development of this technology. Therefore, the Innovation Plan recommends a public investment that we hope will generate returns to the state many times the amount of our initial investment. As an aside, I would just comment here that, like the other initiatives that Representative Berger described, this initiative came out of a competitive process where a number of different industries and representatives of industry came to the Innovation Council with proposals. We had many more proposals than we were able to recommend to the governor and to the legislature. We really picked what we thought were the best of the best. Another example of what I'm describing is the proposed Signature Research Center for Bioeconomy and Sustainable Technologies. Around the world, Oregon has a reputation as a state with abundant natural resources and an ethic for preserving those resources. In the past, that ethic has been characterized by some as a disadvantage when it comes to attracting and retaining businesses and jobs. But our council looked at our reputation and the developing sectors here focused on clean energy and green building as an economic development opportunity. We're seeing an unprecedented level of interest in clean and renewable energy, both as a means of reducing our dependence on foreign oil and as a response to concerns about climate change. Oregon has attracted a significant community of investors and entrepreneurs who think Oregon may be a key location for companies that want to play in these emerging markets. By making a public commitment to research and development in these technologies, we would reinforce Oregon's identification as a place where these companies should want to locate. There are several other components to the innovation plan, which Representative Berger described, and I won't go through them all. The plan also includes some strategies that do not require near-term appropriations from the legislature, including a proposal to improve our ability to commercialize university research and a proposal to create a statewide angel and entrepreneur network to enable emerging companies statewide to access the capital they need to get going. By now, I hope the connection between the Innovation Plan and Oregon's workforce is apparent. The Innovation Plan hopes to create a climate where innovative companies can prosper, where companies that will be industry leaders in years to come choose to locate, and where Oregonians will be able to compete for the kinds of jobs that can provide economic security in an ever-changing world. We all recognize that it's the workers who develop the intellectual property and products that are critical to success in the knowledge-based economy, but we also recognize that these workers need to find jobs that will enable them to put their skills and talents to use to create the IP and create the products that make these companies successful. I know you all have other challenges before you that are critical to our success as a state, not just economically, but generally. To be competitive in a global economy, Oregon needs great schools for our children. We also need world-class colleges and universities, and we need to make sure that our people aren't turned away because they can't afford the cost of education. But even though these big issues are important, I submit to you that the innovation plan should also play an important role in helping us move in the direction of economic prosperity. As I just mentioned, a well-educated and well-trained workforce still needs companies that can take advantage of their knowledge and skills. Just as we want to see our best and brightest students not have to leave the state to get a good education, we also don't want our graduates to feel they can't get the kinds of jobs in Oregon where they can put their skills and expertise to use. By teaming business leaders from the private sector with decision makers from the public sector, including some of your colleagues, we think we've been able to come up with some good ideas that will help make Oregon a place where our workers can be among the winners in the global economy. In closing, I would just like to repeat a comment from the conclusion of our report, and I hope you've all had a chance to see this report, and if you haven't, we can certainly get it to you. As a council, and I say this with a lot of sincerity, we were really humbled by the unwavering enthusiasm of the industry, academic, and community leaders across Oregon we encountered in developing this plan. We were also inspired by the ingenuity that Oregon innovators bring to their work every day. They are inventing Oregon's future, and we are proud to support them in achieving their dreams. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both so very, very much. Committee members, I think the outstanding caliber of testimony that we have received continues here today. Very, very much appreciate your comments and insight that you've offered us. Representative Berger, recognize that you may have to be leaving here momentarily. Before you do, if time would allow, if we could receive written copies of your testimony, that was absolutely outstanding. Do you have time for just one or two questions?
Yeah. My chair certainly won't mind that I'm late.
And Wally, we'll get to you here in a minute, but recognizing that the representative has to perhaps leave, questions or comments from the committee here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
While you're thinking of questions, may I make one closing remark that
Please.
I would like to get on the table? Wally held up the publication here. I want you, as you look at this, to realize that it is a whole plan articulated against itself and represents a whole host of other proposals, other things that we reviewed, and we put together into a package. And we, while I went through the different elements in it, we think of it not as separate elements, but as a plan that has a holistic approach around it. So I hope in your deliberations on it, you keep that firmly in mind.
Thank you so very much. And we have received your plan, and as you'll note, it is highlighted and sticky noted, so the message is sunk in, and I would just say that the message that both of you have delivered us in terms of workforce and economic development, it is jobs, it translates into real jobs, it translates into additional markets, it translates into new cutting-edge companies doing cutting-edge technology, research, implementation. Your investment strategy, a capital investment strategy, mm-hmm. is so critically important here, targeted to the very clusters that you've talked about, and your utilization of our state's really top-notch research facilities, investing in those so that they can turn around and reinvest in jobs and economic and workforce development. Your message is a wonderful one. Representative Berger, you're excused whenever you need to run. Thank you for coming.
And I'm always available for questions, anyone on this. I spent a lot of time on in the interim, and I intend to spend a lot of time talking about it during the session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Committee members, questions or discussion for Mr. Van Valkenburg? Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hopefully that Innovation Council booklet's in my inbox, and I just haven't seen it yet. Thank you for being here, Mr. Van Valkenburg. I have attended a couple of your commission meetings over time and have had a great interest in the Innovation Council, and it has a major impact in my district with University of Oregon there working on Onami and Invitrogen, which is a industry that receives some economic development push and from the state and is participating in one of those new fields that you've mentioned.
If they put it to good use, I'd say.
Yes. It's a great addition to our economic base in my district, so I'm really pleased to see that. My question about the Innovation Council is just one. I know that, there's a lot of discussions out there about open source technology and R&D exchanges that I've been somewhat intrigued by as really a tool to help propel this type of innovation throughout our region. And I know that we're pretty focused on Oregon, but do you see our ability to participate through R&D exchanges and open source technology that I think OSU has also been participating in as being a good thing for Oregon to really get into to help foster those ideas or innovation, or do you think that competition and the fear of losing your idea to somebody else is going to stand in the way of that?
Well, I think that's a really good question, Representative Holby. I guess a couple of comments specifically on open source. We actually considered including a specific proposal to invest in the open source industry in the innovation plan. I think that this is an example of where we made what I think for many of us was a difficult decision, which was that we didn't think the time was right to come to you and request an investment in that particular sector. Open source has the potential, I think, to generate some high quality jobs and some innovative companies over time, and Oregon may have a competitive advantage by virtue of some of the people who are leaders in the open source software movement being located in Oregon. But I think that's still playing out, and you may have seen just the other day an announcement, I think it was actually in yesterday's Oregonian, about a merger between two organizations that are that we're both promoting open source software. I think one of the challenges with open source is that by definition it's about sharing and not necessarily about building protectable assets at the sort of highest level. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't going to be some companies that develop protectable assets in the open source space, but I think from the Council's perspective, and I ended up agreeing that this was the right decision, it was too early for us to be able to say that we thought an investment in that particular part of the economy would be, we could see jobs coming out of that from the investment. So it's the best answer I can give. Now, there's a separate issue in terms of the whole philosophy of open source, the idea of sharing and collaboration, and I think one of the things that I'm excited about that we, I think, have done with Onami and that we hope to replicate with the other signature research centers dealing with sustainability and infectious diseases is a whole new level of collaboration between our public universities and some of the private sector companies that have an interest in these technologies. So instead of it being University of Oregon versus Oregon State versus Portland State, you have the universities coming together to work through these signature research centers, and each can bring the strengths that they have. We're not big enough to compete intramurally in Oregon. I think we need to collaborate more, and if we can do that effectively, and if we can get a competitive advantage by being better at collaborating, we can compete with some of the bigger states and some of the bigger universities more effectively.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, in some ways, this is a little bit of a follow-up on that set of questions. It sounds as though you're really, in one sense, you're describing the open source model as a new business approach that might be expandable way past software, in terms of the collaboration side of it, at least. And my specific question about that is a little bit different. It has occurred to me for some time that government has some particular needs for data management and control that may or may not apply to private business. And I'm thinking about things like the need to be able to access records long into the future, especially archival kinds of things, and the need for open standards in order to be able to store that material and then retrieve it. It would seem to me that the open source environment would be a perfect way, a place, to be developing those standards and to eventually implementing them, and perhaps government spending, which we have to make anyway, in order to set up our own systems, might be directed in the direction that would promote Oregon's open source community. And I wonder if you have a comment about that.
Representative Barnhart, I do... think that is something that we've heard from the folks who are involved in the open source movement, that an early adopter of this newer model of and now I am talking about software or computer systems probably should be the public users of the computer systems, and I think I can't give you details because I'm not deep into it, but I believe that there has been quite a bit of discussion with the Department of Administrative Services here about moving toward more open source based systems for the state, and I think that is something we're seeing in other parts of the country as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Dahl.
Yes, Mr. Van Valkenburg, you talked about examples of collaboration with the full university system. Can you give us a specific area where all the units came together and are working on a specific project?
Well, I think there's actually, Representative Dahl, I think there's actually been quite a bit of that in ONAMI. And, again, I would have to offer up someone who is more deeply involved in ONAMI to explain the technical aspects of that, because I'm not the best person to do that. But I believe certainly Oregon State and University of Oregon, and I believe Portland State as well, have all collaborated pretty significantly in developing some of the nanotechnologies that have come out of ONAMI. And not only are they working among the three of them, but we also see companies like Hewlett-Packard and FEI participating alongside them, so it's a true public-private partnership. But I believe there's been really good collaboration among the universities with ONAMI.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Wally, thank you so very, very much for making it to our committee first thing early here in the morning. And if time would allow, with you as well, we would love to have a written copy of your testimony to include. Actually, we're planning to try and publish a collection of papers and information that we receive from this information portion of our committee's work. So we would we'd love to have that if time would allow.
I was actually instructed by Susie Funkhauser from OECDD, who is my boss on this, to bring 25 copies. So I have those with me, and I'll leave them with you.
Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.
Just a couple of announcements here before we invite Jay Clemens up. Two folks so far have not been able to make it. Senator Deckert is tied up wants very badly to speak before our committee here, and indicates that he's going to try and dash in here on a moment's notice. And when he does, who's ever testifying, my apologies in advance, but we'll hold the testimony at that point, allow Senator Deckert to testify, and get him on to his appointed work. Also, Eric Paulson from Electro, up on the North Coast. They're manufacturers of aircraft tugs and have developed markets worldwide. Unfortunately, his plane is grounded this morning due to fog and freezing fog. And any of you who've ever heard Eric speak, he's a very, very dynamic a speaker. And anyways, wanted us all to know that he fully supports the committee's work, and if there is ever an opportunity for him to appear, he'd like to do so. With that, our next focus will be on linking workforce and economic development. And we're going to hear next from Jay Clemens, president of Associated Oregon Industries. Jay, thank you so very much. It is always an honor to have the head of Associated Oregon Industries, and particularly since, as I understand it, we are the first committee that you're testifying before. So, welcome.
You are. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. It's a pleasure to be here. You are the first committee I've testified before, and I imagine we'll see each other again as we work on down the road. I'm mildly uncomfortable following that presentation that was just made for a couple of reasons. First of all, some of the things that they said were some of the things that I wanted to comment on. Secondly, I thought that was an outstanding presentation, and I was very pleased to hear what was said to you, because that is the direction I believe that Oregon needs to invest in and go in.
Jay, we interrupt this program for late-breaking developments.
All right. Sure.
If you would, please, Senator Deckert, come forward. And you're okay?
Yeah.
Your timing's fine? You sure? Okay. All right. Jay, please.
All right.
Proceed.
I'll try to use my 5 minutes efficiently here. A little bit about me. While I'm new to Oregon and learning a great deal as quickly as possible about the things that we're doing here to support economic development and workforce development, I have a long way to go. And so I don't have a great deal of depth in what is taking place here already. What I can bring to the table, I think, is a very practical 100,000-foot look at some of the things I've seen that work in economic development. I have a pretty strong background in economic development work, and have worked with a lot of companies throughout my career. In retaining them in the marketplace, retaining them in states, expanding them in states, as well as recruiting new companies and entrepreneurial development programs of different types and places that I've worked and been. So I think I bring a kind of a practical application of those things to the table today, and as we work together in the future, maybe can help move some of those things along in Oregon. I have had a chance to look at the programs that you just heard about, as well as some of the strategic initiatives of the Oregon Economic Community Development Department. And I think they're right on. Good fundamental work is being done here. AOI's approach to economic development is to keep a system in the state of Oregon that is competitive for business. There are multiple drivers which encourage investment and encourage companies to grow and stay or come to any state. There are two big drivers in the marketplace today that I get concerned about. One is competitive cost of doing business issues, and we deal with those all the time in public policy areas. And that is first and foremost. If we can't compete in our region, and if we can't compete nationally, we will not be able to compete globally, and we will be out of business. And so when we look at the world of economic development, we look at public policy that has an impact on the cost of doing business. Second issue, which has been around the last decade and a half or so, and is coming back to be a very prominent factor in company decisions to stay, grow, or move to a marketplace, is labor. And skilled and trained workforce is fundamental. Everything we know from the people that study these things say that within the next decade we're going to hit a major labor shortage in this country. And the states that have a labor supply are those states that are going to be competitive. And right now when we look at unemployment in Oregon, we're higher than average. What I see happening around the country is the labor pool is being consumed very quickly in the growing economy that we're enjoying right now. A higher than average unemployment offers us an ability to go sell something. And what we're concerned about is that labor pool be trained and competitive. We've taken a look at some of the things that are going on in the state, Manufacturing 21 program, for example, some of these new initiatives that are popping up. And what I'd encourage you to do as you set state policy is be very supportive of those kinds of programs and aim them well. There are a lot of places around the country spending enormous amounts of money on workforce development programs. They're not always aimed well. Lots of times those programs follow demand instead of getting in front of demand. Something that Wally said earlier, I think, is fundamental in the success of creating good workforce development programs, and that's that you work with industry. And you need a very strong collaborative relationship with industry as workforce development programs evolve. I thought I'd touch just a little bit on one of the things that we've researched in the past, and that's the incentive programs that we see happening around the country that we are going to have to compete against in Oregon. Many states are creating quality investment programs that reward companies for investing in their existing infrastructure, putting more capital investment into their companies. I don't understand yet what Oregon does, but we see states really ramping up in investment programs that reward companies for adding capital investment. As we all know, manufacturing is huge in Oregon. There are a lot of tired plants, and we see some of those plants going away. We have an example of that very thing happening here in Salem right now with Boise. And I think a hard look at what we can do to develop strong quality investment programs to retain capital investment would be a good thing to consider. Many states around the country are putting together mega project funds to attract new companies into their marketplaces. And these funds frequently are in the $1 billion range. That's pretty hard to compete against when you're looking to locate new major industries and employers in the state. And so I believe an area of consideration should be looking at what we are doing in Oregon to be competitive with some of those major investments that we could compete for. Many states are putting together closing funds that help close deals with new employers and with expansions of existing employers. Funds that are related to training people for specific jobs with specific companies. Funds that are related to helping to abate some of the startup costs that go along with new locations. Many states are have training for industry programs that are very agile and can adapt to company demands immediately. The place I just moved to Oregon from has a program that actually provides recruitment, provides training for employees, and it's a big factor in locating companies and helping with major new investment expansions. One of the things that that I've noticed since I've been here in my short time here is that around the concentrated labor pool, specifically in the corridor up and down I-5, there is not a good inventory of project ready sites. And if we're going to grow, if we're going to attract a new industry, we need to have sites that are ready to move on for companies. And there's land out there, and let's figure out how to make it usable. Seed capital funds for entrepreneurial development. It's not all about bringing new companies in. It's about growing your own, too. And we just heard a little bit about capital funds, angel funds, venture capital funds, and anything that the state can do to encourage that will pay great dividends in the future. And I don't want to get into details about the kinds of things we just heard about, but where we're seeing a lot of growth in the new economy kinds of industries is around universities and university-based research. I agree with the cluster strategy, used that over the years, and it's a good way to get at where you want to put your investments when it comes to universities and seed capital and entrepreneurial development. But there's also something out there about in the university systems, we need to be able to fund the kind of research that attracts the top talent in the world. And it's not always built around what you're doing already. And we need to look for opportunities that we can exploit in Oregon and in our university systems to conduct new kinds of research. And there's some very bleeding-edge research that is taking place in this state already, but there can be more. That said, focusing that is very important. There is not an unlimited supply of dollars out there, but we do need a university system that can attract global talent. And if we do, we will find the programs that are likely to bring us the greatest dividends in the future. Those are economic development fundamentals that I've seen practiced around the country. We're in a very competitive environment. Oregon has enormous assets, tremendous quality of life. My family voted with our feet. And we're moving here. There are people all over the country that recognize the quality of this state. But we need to continue to invest in our people, in training, in our industries, And we need to continue to remember that we're in a highly competitive environment, and we can't get so caught up in some of the lifestyle things that we would like to have that we forget about the economic system that drives the tax base and that lifestyle and jobs for our citizens. And so keep us competitive. When I look at industry, when I look at companies, when I look at the private sector, I really divide it up into two kinds of businesses. The first kind of business is the kind of business that imports new dollars into our economy. Those businesses export products and they export services. And it's not all manufacturing. There are a number of different kinds of businesses and industries that import new dollars into our economy. Second kind of business is the kind of business that competes for those dollars in a marketplace. In the economic development world, we really need to focus on the kinds of companies that import new dollars into the marketplace, and the rest will take care of itself. And so when I look at how we should spend money and how we should develop programs and move the state's economy ahead, the first thing I look at is whether or not that's going to evolve into something that imports new dollars into the economy. And that raises the bar for us financially, provides quality jobs, and it increases income of our citizens.
Jay, thank you so very, very much for your comments. Before we entertain questions from the committee, Senator Deckard, would you like to come up and join us here? And we can perhaps ask questions of both of you at the end, if Senator Deckard's time allows. Welcome. Thank you so much for making yourself available on short notice, and we certainly appreciate your efforts at making yourself available.
Oh, well, my pleasure. And this is my first time to do it this session. So, Ryan Deckard, what Washington County does that suffice in terms of? So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, well, first, thank you for scheduling the Oregon Innovation Plan, and I think that's really what my comments would be limited to for one of your first hearings. I think, and maybe you heard from Wally and Representative Berger about the Innovation Plan, and I think you have our booklet in front of you. I guess the one thing that I would touch upon is many of us were sitting here in the 01, 02 recession, and I don't have to remind this committee of the depths of that recession, losing 21% of our budget. And the state made one investment, made one decision that session, and as we cut 21% of our budget, and we said, we're going to put a marker out there. And we did it to the tune of $21 million, $20 million in capital and $1 million in operating funds for Onami, which was the state's marker in nanotechnology. And so I see whenever I mention nanotechnology or one of the disciples of the Oregon Innovation Council, guys kind of, well, what are y'all talking about, nanotechnology? It really is, I think, two things. One is Oregon really looked at where its core competencies are. What are we good at? Instead of trying to play, and biotechnology is the great example of this, where 42 states are involved, we're certainly trying to make our mark there. But we're really competing not just globally, but with 42 other states in terms of making big pushes in biotechnology. Nanotechnology is one that Oregon actually had some core competencies. We did a scan, invested first at the state level in that $21 million, and just in terms of leveraging what it's reaped, President Bush in his last budget named two universities or two systems, line item in the budget, $28 million. One was MIT. And we all know Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the huge largesse that brings in private and federal funding. The other line item in the budget, the current budget, is Onami. It is our little effort, nascent effort out here that's actually not so little anymore, leveraging $28 million. And the products that it will reach from kidney dialysis, which is occurring today, where we're used to these large, unfortunately, large kidney dialysis machines that you would lug around to something that you'll wear on your watch that will do kidney dialysis. And a lot of that research is being done here in Oregon and commercialized into products here in Oregon to as diverse as what we will wear or what our soldiers will wear in Iraq in terms of the type of clothing and the nanofibers and the nanomaterials. Again, in Oregon, another project, I think that one is $10 million, not Oregon funds, that we are just leveraging and bringing to Oregon. And so the investments, and that's one of the past investments that we have made that we in the Oregon Innovation Plan in the governor's budget is $10 million more. But the private and federal leveraging that has occurred just on that one project alone gives us some level of excitement of where the innovation plan as a whole is headed, from wave energy to wind power to the new BESS center. It really is, I think, the cornerstone of our economic development efforts. And so we are, you'll have to pardon our excitement. We are just incredibly excited at the effort and the process that Wally and Dave Chen and many in the private sector led over the last 2 years.
Thank you very much. Senator Deckert, if you have to leave, please feel free. Manage your own time as is necessary. Do you have some time for a couple of questions?
Sure.
Okay. Senator, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Deckert, I think described Anami extremely well. One additional comment, I think, is that because of the excitement that Anami has generated, it has also received a number of substantial private source donations for construction and other things. And in addition to the investments you've already noted from private enterprise. And I think those are examples of how really relatively small amounts of state money, very targeted, have generated lots of excitement, and not just from Oregon, but from around the country. And just simply a comment to add to what you've already said. Thank you.
It's actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we were together just a few months ago in Eugene, and Mr. Loki had just donated, I believe it was $10 million at that occasion, to the Anami Center, private investment from California, no real ties to the University of Oregon, but loves the University of Oregon, and put in $10 million of his own money to back up the research that we're doing.
Anyone else? I know, Senator Deckert, that we're going to be hearing from OSU's Dean of Forestry, Hal Salwasser, here in a subsequent meeting. And I was surprised to learn that the forest products industry, which I think many of us consider to be traditional business and traditional industry in the state, now is so intensely focused on nanotechnology. And in fact, there are many that claim that that particular industry now is one of Oregon's leaders in terms of its attempts to apply nanotechnology to the traditional economy here in Oregon. So the potential is everywhere. It's not just the new economy. We're talking about the entire breadth of our state's workforce and economic development. So any other questions for Jay as well from the committee? Comments? Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Not questions, but Senator Deckert, I appreciate what you are doing, all the members of the UNAMI, and I'm proud Oregonian hearing that the MIT and Oregon was the recipient of the funds, and that's a great thing. I just commend you for the work you are doing.
Thank you. And Jay, I just want to thank you very much for bringing to our committee's attention some of the things that are going on in other states, because as you correctly pointed out, we are in a very, very competitive environment, and if there are other states that are carrying out projects, have investment funds, have strategies that are assisting their businesses and their industries. We certainly need to be aware of the best practices so that we don't lose that competitive edge in those particular areas as well. So a critically important piece. I also want to commend you for noting how important retention strategies are. I think oftentimes we perhaps focus a little too much on the recruitment end of things, and certainly we need to recruit, but there are a lot of companies that have been good corporate citizens in our communities for decades and decades, and they've helped pay the taxes, they've employed the folks in our communities, and to the extent that some of them may need some assistance, be it with research, be it with capital investment, be it with perhaps some new strategies, some new business markets, those sorts of things, then it is critically important for us to make sure that we're taking care of the folks who are already here. Representative Holder, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I always have to ask this question, I guess, and seeing that you're sitting next to Senator Deckert and Representative Barnhart is also on the panel. You know, you had mentioned in your testimony about the importance of us adopting policies that will favor the capital investment in many of our industries. And I totally agree with you about attracting new dollars into the state. I mean, that's clearly a something that has great promise. But at the same time, you're also talking to us about the needed investment to attract, you know, quality people into our educational system, into our university system. And, you know, I'm looking at those two things going, okay, we need the revenue investment over here and over here. And I guess my question is, where do we get the money? So if you've got any great ideas, I hope that you share those with the senator and the representative and their revenue pursuits in this legislature.
I'd leave this one thought, Representative Polvey, and that's that this is not a simplistic issue. We have to make strategic investments in a number of different things, and it's not just attracting new industry, and it's not just in entrepreneurial development and innovation, and it's an array of things. And I think that's where the cluster strategy that's being evolved in Oregon comes to play. It helps you target where you're going to get the best result from investment the quickest. And research. We need to not only do research in our universities, but we need to do research in government and in the private sector organizations that work with government to sort out how to target the state's investment in different programs. What I have not seen here, it may be there, is good research on how Oregon fits into the scheme of things in incentive programs and encouraging new industry and new development. And have we invested in the kind of folks that can help us aim better? And that's what I'd encourage you to do. So it's not just one thing, but it's an array of things, but it's targeting.
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Jay, thank you very much for your testimony. It's very insightful. And you mentioned about the quality of life of our state. Mm-hmm. And what did you hear when you were outside Oregon, what quality of life will we enjoy here, something different from the other states?
I think the natural beauty of this state, the kinds of industries that have been growing here. I'm from the Northwest, and so I've grown up playing in this state my whole life, and so I think that when I'm around the country talking to my peers in the economic development world and in the public policy world, Oregon is a place that has a wonderful reputation and image, and and it is something that we can build on. No major negatives. No major negatives. I think in the world of public policy, and when public policy is developed in Oregon, we need to continue to be concerned about its impact on business and business's ability to be competitive here. And if there's a negative out there, it's sometimes there's a perception that that's not the case. We are so driven by quality of life issues that sometimes we forget about the industries that generate the economy that creates the ability to have that quality of life and continue to improve it.
Representative Golan.
Yes, thank you. Chair, I'd like to ask, we've been hearing over the last 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, two reoccurring themes. One is fill the good jobs we have, and the other is to entice good jobs into the state. If you were the king of Oregon, which would you do first, and
no,
how
you.
Would you? And what I want to direct you to is fill the good jobs we have, because you've given us some points on how we might attract and hold industry. But if you were going to develop a workforce, which we have puzzled with on this council, how would you go about taking the people we have and that are either unemployed or underemployed and training them, one for the jobs we have and two for the jobs that are coming?
Representative Dellum, that's a huge issue. And AOI is, I was pleased to find, supportive of early childhood education programs and getting to kids before they get into the system and lose interest. And AOI has a history of supporting a high-quality education system where you can measure results, and investing in that system in a way that creates a future workforce that is marketable. I don't think that it's just a matter of creating skill programs, but it's also a matter of creating a cultural environment where young people see options besides college, and they see opportunities in front of them that don't require going to a conventional university and getting conventional degrees. What I've seen happen around the country in some states is programs being developed where you catch young people before they're out of high school, when they're freshmen and sophomores, and you put them into very specific training programs, or make, putting into is not the right phraseology. You make available for them training programs that lead them into optional career paths that help fill the kind of jobs I think you're talking about. We hear more and more from employers, the Manufacturing 21 folks, I'm sure, have told you that if you've heard from them already. Where workforces are aging, they're our age, and retiring shortly, and they don't have people to backfill good jobs. I was visiting with a manufacturer in the area recently, and they said they employ about 400 people in the Portland area, and about half of their workforce will leave in the next 5 years or so. And they're deeply concerned about how they backfill those jobs. And their workers make $50,000 to $75,000 a year. They're good jobs. They're jobs that are much higher than the per capita income in the state. And I don't think we're leading young people in the direction of those kinds of skilled jobs. And that's something we need to cultivate into the educational system so that young people see options. Look at the dropout rates here. Why? And you know, we need to catch people very early on and get them to think about their future is more than just going to into a university system.
Absolutely, yes. Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, in your testimony, you mentioned we don't have enough project-ready sites. I thought, excuse me, we are doing a good job from the economic development. Some big industry coming over here, they were happy to see project-ready site instead of taking a year or years. It takes 6 months because we are ready, some of the sites for them. And for you are saying something different. What is your perspective?
I think particularly in the metro corridor here, the greatest asset that the metro corridor has is the people in it. And it's high growth. And when a company comes in from the outside and looks at a marketplace and looks at the labor pool, it's where those concentrations of labor are that they're going to want to be, because that's where their employees are going to be. So they're going to be around many companies today want to be around educational systems that are going to feed them the right kind of people, universities. And in the metro area, there just isn't. What I'm being told by the commercial real estate community and the development community and the economic development community is that there are not sites that are set aside and staged for those kinds of opportunities. And we need to make sure there are. Now, there's a whole lot of land out there when you look east, but that's not where the people are. And so we need to think about that.
But that's what a representative Donald said.
You must have been reading my mind. Seems like this side of the Cascades has the people and we have the land. In your experience, from where you came from, how are we on the eastern part of the state? It's inconceivable to us that there is not land available. We can't comprehend that. Representative Witt and I drove for 3 hours and passed six or seven houses going to a meeting. How are we going to marry these two so that the land that's available and the people that are available can come together? And do you have any experience in that area?
My experience is those kind of decisions are going to be driven by the companies that we're talking about, creating jobs. And where you have a concentration of people that is significant enough to feed an employer, then we have an opportunity. But there are places in Eastern Oregon, like many of the places where I've been, where there is enough population within a radius for certain kinds of companies to be successful. But look where the educational institutions are for the probably higher end kinds of jobs, the kinds of jobs that we're talking about here. And the reality is they're going to be concentrated around the more sophisticated labor pool, educationally sophisticated, and where the companies can have the services that they need to have in order to be competitive. After all of that, I'll give you an example of something that I dealt with last year. A major company, whose name I won't mention, a high-tech company, a manufacturer, computer manufacturer. fought hard for locating this company. Would have meant a couple thousand jobs that were in the $100,000 plus range. It's a big deal. And we threw all kinds of money at them, hundreds of millions of dollars, and told them many times over that we could feed their labor needs. And at the end of the day, we didn't get it. And it's because they felt like we could probably feed their labor requirements. And the cost of doing business was competitive with other places they were looking at. And they liked us. But they ended up in a location where they were more comfortable with the labor pool. And their cost of doing business was substantially more. The tax system and all of the rest of it. And so I think it brought home something that helped us understand what we needed to do in the future to be more attractive to companies like this. And it's not always about money. It's not always about the system that sustains the communities that they live in, the tax system, and some of the traditional cost of doing business issues. But it's truly all about when a company like that makes a multi-billion dollar investment, it's about long-term how they feel about the education system, how they feel about the quality of the labor pool, and how they feel about the ability to be competitive long-term. And it's going to be about people. And so back to preaching about workforce development and education systems, it's going to be more and more and more about being able to give companies qualified people.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You haven't said a lot of things I really disagree with, but I wanted to go back just a step on, you know, where we invest our money, and one of the points you have made, of course, you know, workforce development and, you know, creating the skilled labor we need, you know, and it's interesting that your comments about that are not always about how much the labor costs, but are they, you know, qualified, are they skilled, and are they productive are really huge issues. But, you know, as we're looking at all these investments in education and workforce and capital investment incentives for industries, and the shovel-ready land is an issue that you touched on, and I might add that, you know, I think that one of the problems we're facing as a state that we really haven't come to grips with yet is to enable that land to be shovel-ready, we need infrastructure, and we're seeing federal dollars disappearing from our community, many of our communities, or maybe most of our communities in the terms of sewage treatment plants, water filtration systems, all those sorts of things that we absolutely need to have shovel-ready land. And so I'm wondering if our state should maybe be focusing a little bit more on that infrastructure as opposed to the incentives you're talking about. I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, the infrastructure is fundamental, and I do think there needs to be a concentration on that. What the state's responsibility is versus a local community's responsibility, I don't really have a strong feeling about that. What I've seen happen in the past is it's a collaborative effort between the local communities and counties and states and funding that kind of infrastructure. I think the infrastructure that I've noticed here in Oregon since I've been back in the area is transportation systems. And we need to move people, we need to move goods, and we need to move services. And where I see the biggest infrastructure issue here is probably in the transportation system right now. And I say that after talking with a lot of businesses, a lot of companies, and there's a high level of concern about that. I have not heard much concern about the other, obviously essential. But I think if you develop site-ready places for development to occur, to locate companies, you know, that's part of the equation. It's making sure that the infrastructure is in place to support them.
Jay, thank you so very, very much for your testimony today. As I said earlier, you've given us pause to consider some things that we need to take into account and make sure that we have those bases covered here in Oregon so that we don't miss that potential for additional competitive strategies. Thank you so very, very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I hope to be better informed the next time. I'm learning every day.
Well, we hope to hear from you and AOI throughout this session as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We're now going to hear about workforce training and development from the Director of Apprenticeship and Training Division, Steve Sims, please. If you would, come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Steve Sims, S-I-M-M-S. I'm the administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I apologize for not having written testimony prepared for you. I was asked at the last moment yesterday to come up, and I am happy to be here. I'd like to talk about workforce development from the other end of the spectrum. I think what we've heard about today is essential for this state's future, the big picture, the macro picture. But I want to make a distinction between economic development and job creation and actual workforce development, actually getting people ready to move into a job. When you talk about nanotechnology, you can have all of the high-tech workers that you want, but to build nanotechnology, you need clean rooms, you need sanitary facilities, you need state-of-the-art electronics. You cannot have nanotechnology unless you have highly trained electricians, plumbers, sheet metal workers, and carpenters. You can talk about having all of the site-ready locations in the state that you want, but someone's going to have to grade that site. Someone's going to have to install the plumbing, the electrical outlets. That is done by people who have completed registered apprenticeship program, hands-on workforce training. The statistics vary depending on where you look, but I believe somewhere between 24% and 31% of all Oregonians have a college degree, which means the vast majority of Oregonians do not. How do they obtain competitive jobs to make them an economic driver in our state? How do they obtain jobs so that they can buy a home, support their local property base, property tax base, contribute to their community in a positive way? They do that by obtaining hands-on skills, and that is what happens through a registered apprenticeship program. Approximately 70% of the registered apprentices in the state are in building and construction trades occupations. Another 20 to 25% are in the manufacturing trades, and about 5% are in various service trades. The model of workforce development that is used in registered apprenticeship is probably the most cost-efficient model of workforce development for the state. That is because the cost of apprenticeship training is paid for either by the employer, an employer association, and or organized labor together. Little or no public dollars go in directly to support an apprenticeship program. And that works perfectly in the building and construction trades. there is a smaller percentage of participation within the manufacturing trades because they have not adopted that same model of joint participation and joint sponsorship. I think that our apprenticeship programs, the manufacturing trades, have declined because they have not yet taken up the challenge to say, we will help pay for the cost of this training. We need to develop a partnership. The blue-collar workforce training is not a matter of saying to the public education system, well, where are our workers? No, it's a matter of saying, this is what we need to transform the graduates from Oregon's public education system into successful workers, and then we will do the rest. With respect to all of our programs, building and construction, manufacturing, service, and otherwise, those trades and occupations still face a problem about how to get people who are ready, able, and qualified to enter into these jobs. These are good-paying jobs. The average apprentice in the state during the term of their apprenticeship will earn about $35,000 a year during the course of their apprenticeship. Once they reach journey-level status, I think that Representative Holvey could easily tell you that journey-level workers in the building trades can make $60,000, $70,000 a year. Those aren't bad jobs. They don't necessarily compare to the executive positions, the $100,000 a year positions, but they are good, solid jobs. But how do we make sure that students are coming out of our public education system so they can enter into these apprenticeship opportunities? I want to go back to the fact that very little or no public dollars go into the apprenticeship program. Once they start training them, this is either money from the employer, the employer's association, or the union. They're footing the bill. What they ask of the public education system is to give them people who are ready and able to enter into their rigorous programs. The only way we're going to get there is a greater partnership between industry and the school system, between public education and the people who actually put these individuals to work. I think with respect to registered apprenticeship, we're making great strides in that direction. I think we're going to try to make better use of the workforce development resources that are already here in the state. We're encouraging more and more of our apprenticeship programs to take advantage of the iMatch system through the Employment Department, where they can scan the skills, the educational background and abilities of individuals who are seeking jobs in the state of Oregon. We're working with the Governor's Workforce Policy Task Force to put together a program where we can educate high school teachers, high school counselors about the career opportunities in the trades and about the minimum educational requirements that the trades are seeking. So we can leverage some things that are already there and make sure that we're paying as much attention to the micro end, getting Jane or Jim or Johnny from school into a successful job, into lifetime learning, as we are as far as our investments in the macro picture, making sure Oregon is an attractive place to do business. Thank you.
Steve, thank you so very, very much. Representative Dahl?
If I might, in the education system, we have seen attempts to change behavior before. Not quite in the job market, but with high-risk behavior, smoking, other sorts of things. And we were most successful when we had a program at school that would teach the disadvantages of smoking or the cultural ugliness of whatever that was. But then our product at school was reinforced at home, was reinforced on TV exemplifying the behaviors we wanted. Is that what you're telling us? I guess where I'm going with this is we can't simply ask the school to do this and expect to have it done, because it won't happen. We have to have help from home. We have to have help from the industries. We have to have help from the unions and associations. And we have to have, in my mind, and this is one of the problems that this council is going to wrestle with, how to get the workers we have to where we need them. But I couldn't concur with you more that it's going to take a joint effort, and I also feel a real sense of urgency about this. We can't go back to a preschool program. By the time these kids get out of school, these jobs had better be filled. So I guess I would concur with what you're saying, but I would look to the unions and the trade associations and the manufacturers to help us in the public sector with a cultural change campaign, and then I would go to the schools and ask for help too.
Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Representative Dalem. I think that, as I said earlier, it's time for us to get to a point where we recognize, both from the standpoint of government and private industry, that we both have resources. And in order to make this a successful state and to make these businesses successful businesses, we have to leverage those resources. So business needs to go to our educators and say that, gee, I really want to be successful, and I really want to use the end product that you're giving me. What can I do to help you do a better job? How can I take my curriculum that I use to train my people and make sure that it's an applied curriculum in high school so that you're learning math, science, engineering in an applied setting that you can take here? Educators need to go to business and say, what are the goals? What are the skills? What are the outcomes that you're looking for? Can we have joint outcomes? Can we look at programs where we can share the value of what we each do? We need to make sure that our guidance counselors, even though less than 30% of our high school graduates go on to college, we need to have programs saying, you know what, there are well-paying, honorable professions that you don't have to go to college for. Here, come experience them. Look at them. Get some hands-on activity. Tell your parents about them. We need to make sure that we actually have a system. When we educate, we don't educate for the sake of education. We're bringing them up through a system that gives them a palette of opportunities that students actually know something about and can take advantage of.
I think we're going to form a company. We pretty much agree.
I know that Representative Barnhart had a question here, so as soon as he's back, we had Representative Holvey.
Sure, I'll fill the gap here for a moment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, I was listening to your comments, and you know, it's always a real difficult line when we're talking about workforce development. We've had many industries come before us, this committee so far, and associations, and their message is, we need to invest in a workforce, and it just seems like, for the most part, they're asking government to step in and to fund their workforce development. And we need an educational system that prepares people to go to work, and, you know, all of that is true. But it's kind of, where do we draw the line? Because once we get to workforce development and once kids get out of the educational system or get to the point where they need to enter into the workforce and participate in the economy and learn a job while they're working, you know, we have some manufacturing that support apprenticeship programs, that support their own training, and then others that are looking to, you know, our state to provide the funds for them to do that. And that creates an unlevel playing field out there where you have some groups that are paying for their own training and some groups that are using the state dollars and the tax dollars, and they're competing against each other. I mean, I know that everybody looks to I'm familiar with the union trades and how their system has really been around for 100 years, where they have, you know, employers and worker groups that are both paying for the training, and yet they're competing against others that want the state dollars to compete against them. I mean, it's a really hard line to draw. Where do we draw the line and say, you guys need to put up or shut up, essentially, because I'll look to the trades, the union trades, I don't know what the statistics are, but they produce over 50%, maybe over 60% of the apprentices in this state, and they do that yet with 10% of the market share, while their competitors oftentimes get their training programs subsidized by state dollars. That is not a level playing field in moving our state in the forward direction. How should we address that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I think that first of all, it is true that for the most part, programs that are sponsored jointly by organized labor and their employer association, all of those programs pay their full load for their apprenticeship training. And there are also programs sponsored by non-union employers who do receive some degree of subsidy. I think that it's important to have a level playing field, but what I think is more shocking is that subsidy is shrinking and shrinking. So you're even decreasing more the amount of training that's going on. Whatever public subsidy, if any, that's provided needs to create a level playing field. If there's any subsidy given to one organization, it needs to be given to the other, or we need to abolish those subsidies altogether. Because I think that industry needs to bear the majority of the cost or the obligation for making sure that they are training their workforce. But I want to take that back up to a larger scale again, and we talked about the incentives that we create for employers to come into this state and the things we do to make this state attractive, the things we pay for with our tax dollars. And those are important from the job creation and the economic development standpoint, bringing the job opportunities into the state. But I think it's fair. Once we have brought those opportunities here and have provided certain inducements to bring those jobs into the state, I think it's certainly fair and eminently reasonable to say, now what are you going to do, since we've provided these incentives and these inducements, what are you going to do as an employer to work with our system and make sure that you're contributing equally with our education system to develop the workforce that we need? It should not all fall on the shoulder of the state. There needs to be a responsible way on the part of businesses and industries to say, we know what we want from our workforce. That's why we chose to come to this state. We are willing to put these dollars forward to support our training, support our workforce, and to support our state system of education to make sure that it's giving us the product that we need that we will then mold into our future workforce.
Representative Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Steve, I heard you mention guidance counselors, and that's an interesting subject for me. I believe that we don't train our guidance counselors in the opportunities that are available other than higher education, and in fact, I put in a bill to actually do that. Could you comment on that a little bit more?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I would agree with you. I think, and I'm no expert in the state education system, but from talking to people throughout the education system, I know that there is some pressure to get people into a four-year college and move students in that direction. So we push them there. To a large extent, many parents push their students in that direction. So there's this inertia that we're going to send you to college even if you don't fit into that square peg. We're going to push you there. And so naturally the counselors would feel that same pressure. I think we do a disservice to our students and to the people who fill those positions as counselors. And I know from talking to counselors at my children's school that it's not like it used to be where you had five or six counselors at a high school. You might have one or two, and they might share two or three schools within their district. They've got a lot of pressure too. I think we have an obligation to do a better job of training them for their job and making sure that they know the full palette of opportunities that are available there, that they know the best assessment tools that are available for giving a student advice. I think that part of the system needs to take into account that these people are kind of the gateway for where these students are going to go in the end. That's why we have been working with the governor's workforce policy cabinet to at least on a pilot basis do some training to get high school counselors into private industry training centers so they can see what goes on there, not just what the career opportunities are, but have them do some shop math and have them look at the equipment so that they can talk meaningfully and knowledgeably to students about that. That's a real small effort we're making. I think that effort needs to be broadened throughout the state, not just the building and construction and manufacturing trades. We need to do a better job as we educate our students of letting them know not only what the ABCs and the math requirements are, but letting them know what the world holds for them once they complete their education.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.
Steve, in our Monday hearing, we had a discussion about what happens to a lot of our workforce in the decade between high school graduation and those that end up in apprenticeship. And I think what we found was it's not unusual for someone in their 30s to enter apprenticeship. It's not appropriate to assume that is necessarily a lost decade, but certainly in an environment where we have employers telling us that they're facing a veritable train wreck in terms of an adequately trained workforce, and one would have to presume that the wages that the apprentices end up with, first, the wages are better, and secondly, it is a career path at that point because folks tend to stick with it. So, what are we doing in terms of trying to avoid the potential for a lost decade, and how can we transition those students into a career path more quickly?
Sure, Whit, I think that's an excellent question. You are correct. The average age, we last calculated this in 2005, of a newly registered apprenticeship, someone entering the program for the first time, is 26.6 years of age. So they're missing about 8 or 9 years after they leave high school. And I don't think they're necessarily lost years. I think that many of our program sponsors will tell you that the average 17, 18, 19-year-old getting out of college isn't prepared to enter into the responsibility of an apprenticeship program, isn't prepared to handle heavy equipment, work with energized electrical lines, isn't prepared to come to work every day at 7:30, isn't prepared to go to class two nights a week. So a lot of them say that's a period of learning and maturity for those individuals. And I think there's a lot of validity in that. Why do they need to have that 7 or 8 years of getting a different type of on-the-job training, learning a job in the school of hard knocks and bouncing around? Why do they need that? Because, again, I think there's something missing. There's a lack of connectivity. I'm not going to say there's necessarily something missing at the education level. There is some connectivity missing between what industry wants coming in and the outcomes that we're teaching in our school. So I think what needs to be done in that area and what we're trying to do is only a start. But we need to make sure that there's continuity, that there's a continuum, that when someone leaves high school, they are ready, willing, and able to go. I think not only through our school counseling system, but through our employment department and some other workforce strategies, we can say, look, if Johnny is interested in becoming an electrician, but they're not quite ready and responsible to enter a program, how can we hook Johnny up with opportunities as a material handler or a parts handler? We need to make sure that we're putting people where they want to go or putting them on the path to where they want to go instead of cutting them out after they complete their 12th grade education and say, good luck. We as a system need to build that connectivity, and I think that that's going to take time, and it's going to take a lot of cooperation from both our existing education system and from our employer base.
Representative Bornhardt.
I've been in and out of the room, and so I apologize. I'm asking a question that you've already answered. Several times you've alluded to completing high school, and it has occurred to me and several of the people we've had in earlier days that perhaps this membrane ought to be a bit more permeable. rather than thinking about finishing high school as an end of one project and the beginning of another one, that perhaps we ought to back up a bit and think about some of the high school years as an introduction to workforce issues as well for students, rather than thinking about the diploma as the beginning point to go looking for some kind of workforce experience. What are your thoughts about that idea?
Representative Barnhart, I think you're 100% correct. That goes back to the applied learning model, that your sophomore, junior year of algebra needs to be articulating to your shop algebra, your shop math. Your science classes need to be articulating with things like electrical theory. And so that, again, takes active cooperation between business, industry, not just in the apprenticeable trades. When we talk about the knowledge gap for people who want to go on the college track and wind up working in high tech, well, why aren't we trying to integrate parts of that curriculum into our high school curriculum? So you are finishing the module that will complete all of your math requirements, but perhaps it's also a module in applied electronic mathematics. Perhaps it's a module in construction geometry instead of just a geometry class. We need to bring the people together. And I think there has been some initial work done by the Department of Education in this area, but we need to step that up. We need to make it real. We need to make it live. We need to make it not simply an educational endeavor, but a joint endeavor between business and education.
Thank you.
Representative Bell.
I thank Representative Barnhart. I think he set my question up. We heard earlier from the innovation-based strategies and economic development. This committee, then, would do a service if we were to bring the community college, the apprenticeship providers, unions, associations, and employers, public schools with their counselors, the employment department, together in a similar type of organization, and develop some strategies for training our young people quicker, making them smarter sooner. So I think that might be one of the things that we could look at getting done, is establishing an innovation-based strategies in workforce development and bring the players to the table and put some seed money to that.
Representative Dallum, I would completely support that, with the caveat that it needs to be an equal footing discussion where business labor can say, these are the outcomes we need, not just hear the drivers from the education side.
Well, I think that when the innovation group got together, they came to the table as equal players, and everyone, I would hope they were, but I can't imagine us coming to the table with lesser participants and greater participants. Unless, of course, one was a representative, then perhaps he would be. I dallied.
Anyone else? Steve, just real quickly here, opportunities for non-traditional apprenticeships and those sorts of things?
Sure, we would really appreciate that at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I think that slowly we're moving in that direction. I think that the apprenticeship model of training, just the model, is very simple. Industry recognized training standards, supervised on-the-job training, related classroom instruction would work well in a broad variety of occupations. Fortunately or unfortunately, the concept of registered apprenticeship carries some negative connotations that some industries don't want to come to. For example, people say, as Representative Holvey alluded to, that it's union dominated. Well, we have more open shop programs in the state of Oregon than we do non-union programs. Well, it's only for construction and manufacturing. No, that model can work anywhere. We have thousands of students in community colleges, for example, studying accounting, cosmetology, a broad range, a broad variety of subjects, who are probably working, and not to disparage the jobs, as a barista at a coffee shop or pumping gas. Boy, it'd be great if we could somehow get them into a paid training opportunity that matches up with the education that they're receiving in the community college, making sure that, both the work on the job training and the related instruction tie into some industry norms and progress them through so they're getting paid while they're learning. This would work. This could apply. And I think that slowly, as we begin to build a greater partnership with the state workforce system, we're going to see those opportunities come to fruition. And I think we will slowly, because old habits die hard, and I think it'll take a while for people to say, hey, you know what? Putting the education together with the training, with the on-the-job training really does work. I think we'll slowly see a growth in apprenticeship in non-traditional occupations.
Representative,
somewhat of a follow-up to that, I would say, Steve, if we put you in charge of or the head of the innovative-based workforce development innovative program, you're bringing some pretty entrenched, hidebound, traditional positions to the table, and it would require a great deal of change. But the alternative is not acceptable to anyone at the table.
I think, once again, we're in agreement, Representative Dowell, that I don't think we have a choice at this point.
No more.
Steve, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.
You've given us a lot to think about, particularly when we're talking about workforce development. We have roughly, round numbers, 70% of Oregon's workforce that's not going on to college. And I think you've suggested a pathway here for us for good jobs, sustainable jobs, a way that we can help to sustain Oregon's economy and hopefully provide that adequately skilled workforce that we have now been told repeatedly by employer after employer that's been before this committee that we're facing a potential train wreck if we don't get those skills. Certainly there's no higher standards to which our workforce is trained than our apprenticeship programs, and I thank you so very much for your very insightful comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Ellen, would you give us a brief description here of what we have online here for Friday's hearing?
Yes, thank you, Chair Witt. For this Friday, beginning at 8 a.m., we're going to be looking at workforce development in select industry clusters. From the forest products industry, we'll be hearing from the Carpenters Industrial Council, the Oregon Department of Forestry, the OSU College of Forestry, and the Oregon Forest Research Institute. And from healthcare, we'll be hearing from the Oregon Nurses Association, Providence Health Systems, and the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute.
Thank you very much. That's kind of the old economy, the new economy, and the future economy. So with that, if there are no further questions or comments, the committee stands adjourned. Thank you.